So today I'm going to talk a bit more about experimental design and probability statistics, partly bringing in some of the material from the other week when I had to cancel the lectures. So it's going to be pretty much a run through it, a bit speedy, but you can read up on the slides and we'll put up other materials. Empirical methods. So generally, just to remind you, so the first few slides are going to be a bit more just going over and making sure we know where we are here. So empirical methods. We can look at doing exploratory data analysis, and we can look at statistical hypothesis testing. So we might have exploratory techniques for initially visualizing, exploring, summarizing, modeling. This is at the stage when we're looking to generate hypotheses. Once we know what we want to test, we have a hypothesis, then we can have more confirmatory procedures for testing these and testing predictions. So we might talk more about statistical hypothesis testing. Empirical means relying on or derived from observation or experiment. So we can talk about empirical studies. And empirical studies don't just mean experiments. They can mean other ways of collecting data, such as observations, interviews, talk aloud protocols, these sorts of things, but we're not going to go into detail on what all those different things are. But just to say, there's a wide range of different methods you can use for collecting data out there. If you look at any particularly social science textbook on methodology, it'll take you through those. Ideally, empirical studies should be informed by theories, and these theories informed by observation. Okay, so we tend to proceed in science by selecting research questions, devising hypotheses, experimentally seeking evidence, and we have to decide what research questions are interesting and what methods we use to answer them. As I said, the first few things are just going to be going through, you know, summarizing where we are already, so a bit of duplication of what you've had. Experiments, if you're running experiments, they tend to fall into two broad categories. That is exploratory ones, where you're not really sure what you're looking at. So this is when we said you're trying to generate hypotheses. And confirmatory ones, when you have a carefully formulated experimental question that you want to test relevant to your research. So exploratory studies, you generate data that may raise various questions, select suggest relationships. So when I say aspects of a system being investigated, I'm saying, you know, we're primarily looking at humans as a system, but if you were also trying to do a computational model in a computer, it might be that you're looking at. Trying to determine what parameters might be employed, and the results tend to be preliminary models, preliminary causal models, and helping you get more precise questions to narrow down and formulate what hypotheses to pursue. So they're more about indications of behavior, what aspects are interesting, where to look next. So if you have theories, for example, about how some aspect of interaction works, and you go and observe people interacting to start off with, and then you look and see what they do, you observe their behavior, you might then decide to do a more organized exploratory study to focus on a particular aspect. And from that, then, you might then generate specific hypotheses that you then would test with a more confirmatory experiment, which tend to follow on. So in this case, we're talking about precise, specific questions, either following from the results of the exploratory work and hypothesis suggest, or it could be following from other people's work previously, like theories they have or studies they've done. You design an experiment to answer that question, and you have to obviously give thought to whether the answer that's provided is unique. That is, when you get a set of results, is there just one explanation for those results? Or might there be other explanations that you may have to do further studies in order to rule out? Okay, so the best designed experiments tend to produce results consistent just with one explanation. Frequently in experimental work, in exploratory work, you're looking for, the things you have to look out for may be things like suspicious data. So it may be things that, you know, suggest a cause and effect relationship that warrant further work. You may use various visualization techniques to do this. So for example, if you collect your data and you present it in some form of visualization, which Henry will talk about tomorrow, then you might see, well, are there patterns there I can spot? Are there patterns where, you know, the data is less? Is there places? Is this going to help me decide where to look? And when you're later then doing the more this test to confirm this, you will use statistical techniques to reassure you that the patterns are real. And when we say a pattern, you might say, well, okay, I think learning this way versus this way is more effective for the learner. And that might start out with just being, you get a bunch of data, you say, look, there seems to be a trend here, that's great. Now I'm going to do a better study, a more tightly controlled study, where I will then use statistical techniques on the data. Typical hypothesis, factor X affects behavior Y. Typical null hypothesis, there's no effect of X on Y. So we have to also think about what we measure about X and Y to make those decisions. Now, we can talk also about observation versus manipulation studies. So observation means looking at the population to see if X correlates with Y. That is, it varies with it in the same way. Or we can have manipulation experiments where we make a change to X and we look and see what happens to Y. But we have to make sure that any change is only due to the thing we believe it to be true. To say a bit more about that in a second. When we're trying to disprove hypotheses, we're basically, as I said, you know, we've talked about this before in the other lectures, you formulate a question, you formulate a hypothesis, you test if there is evidence that supports this. So you might have a hypothesis, children born October to December show more advanced language development than those born January to March, for example. Or the second one there is actually in relation to an example I'm going to show you later on in the lecture. So Stand Up, which is a system that helps children with communication problems, it could improve social communication skills of children with complex communication needs. And I'll talk about the example of that a bit later. So you design an experiment effectively to disprove the hypothesis, that is, you assume the null hypothesis, there is no difference here. A positive result, though, if you get one, you have to think, what is this just caused by what I believe it to be, the variable that I identified, or is there some other factor? So in fact, if you look at the reason I used the example, children born October to December show more advanced language development, actually, one of the main reasons for that may simply be children tend to start school in October, therefore the children in that range may be getting more schooling than the others. You see what I mean? So it may be actually that's the major factor we need to look at. When you are trying to disprove a hypothesis, in general, if you have a negative result, it is disproving the hypothesis. So we can categorize experiments, as I said, as observation or manipulation. And this is independent of whether exploratory or confirmatory. Okay, so a manipulation experiment, the general structure is you're looking at the influence some factor has on some output. You proceed by altering the factor in a controlled way and you measure the changes of the output. So you are manipulating one of the factors, but the other is, you're manipulating it to see what the impact is. And these tend to be what we mostly think about when we're talking about experiments. Now, there are also observation experiments where you may have a factor that cannot be manipulated, where usually where the participants are people, usually where it's either not possible or it's not ethical to manipulate them. So if you believe, for example, if you have a theory about language development and you think, okay, exposure to language through parents affects development. Well, one way of testing that, if you're doing a manipulation experiment, was get a bunch of newborn babies, take the parents away. Look and see how the language develops. Okay, not ethical. You're not going to be able to do that. So you can't do that as a manipulation experiment. What you can do, though, is you can observe cases where children have had less exposure to language with their parents and those where they've had more exposure to language from their parents and look at their language development and then see what you might infer from that. So it's an observation study rather than manipulation study because in that case, it actually isn't ethical to make such changes. So what you do in these cases, you divide the population into the groups of the factor of interest and you try and make it so each group members have the same combination of factors, i.e. things that you think will have an impact on it should be balanced across them. And you look for differences in the output between the groups. So you might look to see, identify a bunch of children who for some reason or other have not had, you know, strong interaction with the parents, or who parents haven't used a lot of language with them. Maybe you could, for example, choose children of parents who can't speak. That would be one way of doing it. Or maybe where the for some reason or other the child hasn't had just the amount of interaction for whatever reason. And then you would look and see, right, decide some sort of measure of language development, and then compare them with a group where you have evidence they have a lot of language development. And you'd hope then any results are the results of the different grouping there. So when do you use which? Observation experiments, say when you can't directly manipulate X, and you group subjects based on the measurements of X. So obviously, if you're looking at children born January to March and those born October to December, you can't change when someone's born, so that has to be effectively an observation experiment. And then you might use things like standardized tests on that. Manipulation experiments, when the factor is directly manipulable, so you might have two groups of children using the software I was talking about and other tools, then assess the social communication before and after. And then you look and see if there's any relationship. Is there a correlation, or is there differences between them? And just a general sort of aside here, when you're doing studies, one thing to think about, particularly if you're doing studies with humans, is what's the context in which they're taking place? So if you want to maximize the control and, you know, do major manipulation and minimize the number of variables that may have an impact, then you might be going for the upper part of this, where you're saying, fine, let's have all our subjects, let's run all our experiments in a lab. Now, one of the problems may be that if you're trying to make inferences and test theories about the real world, then you may have actually removed some of the factors that have an influence. I mean, you've done it intentionally to ask a very particular question, but it also may not be realistic, or what's usually referred to being as ecologically valid. So the other extreme may be you have something going on in a real environment. It's more quasi-experimental, that it's not as tightly controlled, and it's with real students. So in the area I work in, I'm very interested, mostly interested in using educational technology with children. Now, you know, a lot of issues of cognitive science come up into that. Some of them come up in relation to development, like the language development, some up in relation to, if you're developing different tools, what sorts of ways would you use them? What do you believe about learning that would help them? Also, it comes up in the fact of, if you're trying to design tools and interfaces for them to use, then there's a whole other area of HCI, human-computer interaction, that you have to take account of there. Now, if you're doing any research in learning, and particularly in education, and are looking at cognitive science questions to do with that, one of the problems is, the more you remove and make the situation lab type, the more actually you're losing a lot of the other richness of the environment that you may then need to put if your theory turns out to be correct, then to put into practice. So frequently in educational research of this type, you'll find that you don't tend to get very controlled, tight studies of the type you might get if you're looking at, say, something like exploring vision or attention. So depending on what you're looking at, you may have to decide where you go on this continuum. So those that are more realistic may be more valid, but you don't get as much control. Those that are more constrained and lab-based, you get more control, but maybe less valid, as in applicable to the real world and generalizable. So you're always also looking for the results of your study to be generalizable, not just to that group in that place at that time, we have to say something about the wider population. Okay, when we have other factors, when we look and see what effects we have from running a study, we have some behavior we're measuring, we get some variation in it. As I said, we want to be sure that the variation we're getting that we're interested in is in relation to the factor we're interested in, that is, in the variable we were manipulating. But there may be other factors that influence it, and they may be contaminating our experiments. So, as we said, we have to try and make sure that there's only one explanation. And when you look at data, you also need to ask about what else might account for the effects described. So if we take just a quick example here of a maths tutoring system. So you have, we talked earlier about subtraction and how a lot of people have done research on how subtraction works and the sorts of errors that children make. So you decide that you're going to use that, incorporate it in designing a tutoring system for maths. So you're using your cognitive model as a basis for this. You're using the knowledge of the sorts of errors and what sort of models of errors they may have. But you've decided instead you're going to scale it up and use it for teaching calculus. But you also want to know about how humans teach calculus in order to be able to model that in your system. And we might say, what can we infer about this? What's feasible to incorporate in this? You know, what are we going to model about the teachers teaching in the system? One thing we might think about is what sorts of errors do the learners make and what should the system do when they make errors? Now, in terms of how that relates to more the cognitive modelling side, it would be trying to model what a human tutor does when they are teaching, and that is giving feedback to a student. So one issue might be, what sort of feedback do they give when a learner makes an error? And what, and in turn, you're also having to unpick what sort of model they have of the learner in order to decide what feedback to give. But just focusing on, you know, if we were designing a study for this, so what should the system do when the student makes errors? Well, you might observe human tutors and discover, so you might do an initial exploration study that's just an observation. You discover that tutors tend to either give feedback immediately or flag to the student they've made an error or let the student realise for themselves that they've made a mistake and ask for help. Now, the reason for the latter may be that if you know something about learning and you know that metacognition is important, that is knowing about your own learning and being able to think about your own learning, then actually it's better if, as a learner, you are able to realise when you make a mistake, and if and that's a good skill to have, than just to be told when you make a mistake. So maybe, you know, you're using that in the design here. So you decide, well, I've got this tutoring system. Now, this actually in itself can be a useful experimental tool. I could take a tutoring system and I could, in it, I could change the types of feedback it gives in order then to vary it to see what the impact of different types of feedback is on learners. And this is loosely based on a study done by Corbett and Anderson. So you start off and say, what hypothesis am I going to have here? Well, my hypothesis is going to be, I'm going to start out saying, I think giving immediate feedback is best. Learners will best learn if they get immediate feedback and therefore don't go down the path of making the errors. But if we just say that, immediate feedback is best, that's too loose as a hypothesis. It's not specific enough. So one of the things often when you have a research question you have to think about is, I may have my question, but is it really operationalized? And again, I think Henry talked about this, about operationalizing. We talked about it in relation to other bits of the course. But what we're saying here is you have to be more specific. So you might say, well, okay, let's come up with our experimental hypothesis. In this case, it's going to be differences in performance on a specific test will be shown between students given no feedback and students given immediate feedback. So you're effectively saying, I'm looking at two different populations here of students, one with no feedback, one with immediate feedback. I'm going to give them tests and I'm going to measure their change in performance on the test, and that is going to tell me whether the feedback is, and if I find statistically they appear to come from different populations, then that maybe gives me support for my theory about feedback. So your null hypothesis would be there is no difference in performance shown by students giving immediate feedback or no feedback, i.e. we believe they all come from the same population and the statistically there's no reason to believe otherwise. So we might come up with an experimental design where we say, okay, actually I'm going to make this a bit more complicated. I'm going to have an error flagging condition, immediate error flagging and correction, error flagging, no correction, and feedback on demand. Maybe I decide they're the things I'm going to look at specifically. And then also, to eliminate alternative explanations of the data, I'm going to have a control condition. And that's going to give me sort of a baseline for comparison. Rather than say, let's compare these with students who just do normal maths and calculus teaching, I'm going to still get them to use, they might still use the tutor, but they might not get any feedback at all. So it would get a comparison group. Okay, so in this case, the independent variable, as you know, manipulated by the experimenter, the dependent's not manipulated, look to see if it has an effect. So the independent variable here will be the type of feedback. Dependent, it could be time to complete the exercise, it could be post-test performance. Well, given what we said our hypothesis was, we'll be looking at change in performance on a test. And you keep whatever's taught constant, you make sure everyone learns the same things, because if you don't, then obviously that's something else you changed, and maybe that's a variable that actually is giving you any change. So other things are extraneous variables, that is, things that vary without us wanting them to. If we want to control for them, then there are a number of different things that we can do. So we can actually say, well, if we believe something else is having an effect on this, then let's make this a variable that's part of the experiment. So for example, if we believe time of day is an effect on this, later in the day, people get more tired, therefore they're not as awake, therefore when they come to actually doing learning, it's not as effective. So we control for that by making sure that all those conditions all happen at the same time of day. Or we could say, well, we can't do that. The way it works out, we can't do that. So we'll just make that a variable in it, time of day. We'll put that in as a variable when we're doing the testing. Okay, we can also partition the cases such that the variable cancels out. So for example, if we thought there was effect of gender on maths performance, and that was going to be a factor also in this study, then we'd have to, one thing we could do is collect a number of pairs of male-female such that each pair's matched on maybe age, socioeconomic class, training, whatever, so that basically any differences would be attributable to gender, so we'd be controlling for that. We could also just take a random sample of the population and look at that. One thing to be careful of, though, is that samples are really random. That is, you have to have a big enough population that random is really random. And in the tutorial this week and in today, then that's also one of the issues that we'll look at there, is that if you don't have a big enough population, then actually random may not really be random. It may be that you're getting a bias in your results. So you have to be careful about selecting variables. So just want to say a bit now about, so how do we choose participants and how do we organize them? And generally, what design do we use to help us control for these variables? So one of the big variables in humans, when we're doing any study with humans, and particularly if we're looking at something like learning, is individual differences. You know, not everyone is starting at the same place. Therefore, how do we know that if we're looking for any change in their behaviour, it's attributable to what we manipulate rather than the fact they just started out different? Okay, so we could say, fine, what are we going to do? Are we going to have different conditions and we use the same subjects for the different conditions? Or are we going to have different groups of subjects for each condition? So if you think back to some of the studies you've looked at so far, in some of those cases, the same participants did several different conditions. In other cases, you've got completely different groups of participants doing the different conditions. So this is to say a bit more about what the pluses and minuses are of each of those. So if you have different subjects, then you've got what's called a between group design. So each condition that you have in the experiment, you have a different group doing it. And you just make an assumption that they're all from the same population. Now, the great thing is that everybody's just doing the thing once. So if it's in the case of the tutor, you would say, okay, if I've got three different feedback conditions and a control condition, I've got four groups. So I need four groups of participants. They all use the thing once, but under the different condition. The design's really simple. You don't get order effects. But the problem is individual difference going to get in the way? Well, if I can do this on 800 students, so I've got 200 in each group, then I'm probably going to, you know, factor out individual differences. But that's not realistic. More likely, I'm only going to get 20 students in each group, so maybe individual differences play a bigger part. So I may need more subjects, but I may not have the choice. We can then instead use same subjects. That is, if we use the same subjects on every condition, then we don't have any problem with individual differences and we don't need so many subjects. So in this case, all the students would use the tutor under the four different conditions. But then you say, well, okay, well, that's a problem because if they've used it and learned, then actually when they come to the second condition, they're going to know more already. So maybe that's a problem. So the order may have to be varied. Now, in any study where you're doing using the same subjects for different groups, you do want to make sure that you balance the ordering such that it isn't just simply effect of whatever they did first. Also, if you have part of it is that they do some sort of test to test, if you know, if the variable you're looking at, the change in, is their performance, and it's on, for example, some sort of test, then what you may need to do is have different versions of that test that they do for each of the different conditions. But then you've got to make sure that the versions don't differ. It isn't the fact you get a change because one set are harder than the other. So if, for example, it is a learning type study like this and you have got them doing a maths test to see if there's change, then what you have to have is isomorphic problems. That is, problems that are equal difficulty of the same type across the different conditions. And you have to vary them as well across the different conditions. So the good thing about same subjects, you don't have so many subjects, avoids individual differences, but your design is more complex, you need isomorphic problems, you may get order effects. If it's something in relation to learning, then you're going to get testing and learning issues. Also, if they're doing more, you're going to get boredom, fatigue issues as well. So you need to make sure you control for all these. Okay, a third alternative is a matched subjects design. What you do here is you say, okay, I'm going to use different groups, so it's like a between groups design, but I'm going to pair everybody up so that I match the subjects in each of the conditions. But I have to think first, well, what's going to be important to match them on here? Well, in this example, if I'm looking at their improvement in maths when getting different types of feedback, well, it's probably important that they're all the same intelligence. So if I've got a group that has a variable level of ability, I'll distribute them evenly across the four conditions, ideally matching them up with each other. Another factor might be previous maths experience. Another factor might be previous performance on maths. Another factor might be gender. So what you would try and do there is match your participants such that you have similar participants on these factors in each of the groups. What you're effectively doing is trying to rule out that variable as a possible factor by controlling it by saying we'll make it evenly spread across the groups. So the good news is you get all the pluses of between groups design plus you reduce individual differences. The bad news is it's hard to get appropriate matches, particularly if you've got small numbers. So in the particular study they're talking about, what they actually used was a between groups design. Okay, generally when you're choosing between designs, the sort of things you have to think about are validity and reliability. Validity is, does it measure, you know, are you actually measuring or checking what you believe you are measuring? So for construct validity, does it measure what it's supposed to? External validity means, is it valid for this population, whatever it is you're using as a measure? And when we talk about measures, we're talking generally, or metrics, we're talking about the things they two are using to collect data that, you know, involve, you know, counting or numbers. And ecological validity, is it representative of the context? We also talk about reliability, that is, would you get the same results if someone else ran the study, or if you did the study in a different context, or you did it at a different time of day, for example? So these are issues you also have to think about, and they also will influence your study design and how you actually go about choosing a study design. Okay, just want to say a bit about data now. So generally, when you're testing hypotheses, you're running experiments, you're collecting data. And the data is what you're then using, you know, you then use the stats on the data to and then decide whether you actually have anything you can say as a result. So the results we collect by the various methods of data, and they're often numerical representations, but they may be of different types. The different type they are will also affect what you can do with them. So we have to think about questions like, what can we do with data? What form does it take? How do we analyze it? Data is a representation of reality, but it's actually affected by our suppositions about the nature of that reality. It encodes the behavior that we think is important. So it's what we're using as a way of representing. When we're saying there are changes, you know, we're studying behavior, we're looking at the impact, we have theories about it, it's what we're using to represent that behavior. If we had a sequence like this, say we collected a bunch of data and we had a sequence like this, then we also need to do things like look for trends in the data. Looks like we've got a bunch of data that's in about the 3 to 9 category. Looks like we've got a bunch that's about the 12 to 17. Oh, hang on, we've got a 1304 in there. So maybe if we were doing how long does it take someone to respond on a test, we're doing a reaction time test, and these were the numbers we've got, then this may suggest that person really didn't react. But maybe it just means that they just walked out halfway through the study. You know, either way, just looking at the data may make us think, well, actually, is that somehow an anomaly? Do we need to count it? Do we need to consider it? Or was it the case that person never saw that, you know, you were getting them to react to something and they never saw it to react for it, even though they tried? Should you be including that data? So we have to decide what to do about it. In general, when we're talking about data, there's sort of a categorization of data that people tend to use is qualitative versus quantitative data. In general, in social science, you tend to use a lot more qualitative data. In more traditional science, people tend to use more quantitative data. Qualitative is usually descriptive data. In the sorts of examples we might be using in informatics, say, if we were looking at something like how people use and interact with an interface, we're trying to better understand the communication between the person and the computer. We might be looking at system behavior, user experience. We might be using data collected by methods such as observation, questionnaires, interviews, a whole bunch of other ones here that I'm not going to talk about in detail, but if you want to find out about, then you can follow up some of the references. And this tends to be more subjective, but it doesn't mean it's any less valid. Quantitative data tends to be numerical data based on measures of variables relevant to performance or user experience. They tend to be obtained more from empirical studies, such as experiments, but also could be like questionnaires or interviews. And they're more often amenable to statistical analysis, and they're usually considered to be more objective. Okay, so we talk about different types of data, and in order to design studies, collect data, and know how to analyze the data, you have to understand what data it is that you're collecting. If you don't, then you may end up making invalid assumptions. So we can talk about nominal data. We talk about whether, and this also is referred to as categorical data, and whether data falls into classes. So if we talk about the weather, we talk about it being bright, cloudy, wet. We might give different treatment conditions to something, in which case we might categorize them by the different treatments. Ordinal data we can put into rank and impose some ordering. So we could say, well, okay, a day is either cold, warm, or hot. That's an ordering. When you do any coursework, you get assignment grades, and we say, okay, A, B, C, D, that's an ordering. If we're looking at how someone has difficulty with interacting with an interface, we could say, okay, they find it very easy, difficult, very difficult. That would be an ordinal scale. Numerical data comprises numbers, so for example, maybe actual temperature is a common type. So we need to know what we're doing. So just a quick example here again. So I said different categories of user, on the example I'll talk about later, we might have different categories, and there is no ordinal relationship with these. They might be CCM, which might stand for a child with complex communication needs, a typical developing child, a complex communication needs adult, or a speech and language therapist. They might be the sort of people that are involved that we're getting to work with and look at how they interact. If we're looking at language errors, it could be different types, or if it's subtraction errors, different types. And often nominal data is often categories of objects. As I said, with the ordinal data there, we could have categories in how you might interact. We could talk about people in terms of their age. It could be children under 12, teenagers aged 13 to 18, adults over 18. And we could order those. But one thing to note here is, although we've ordered them, there's not a scale on which we can place these, in that if we say something is easy or average in difficulty, we're not saying how much easier or how much harder. It's not saying what we call hard is twice as difficult as what we call easy. We're just saying that's an ordering. So things like one, a few, hundreds, that will be an ordinal scale. In a numerical scale, for numerical data, then we can talk about interval data, where the distance between the points matters. So if you look at things like weather forecasting, then you have temperature in degrees Celsius. You can reason about the intervals. So if yesterday it was 14, it was 6 units above today's temperature. We can say that, and that is meaningful. We sometimes want to plot these things. So we're plotting, for example, variation in temperature against time. But also we have scales where we talk about ratio scales. There's an absolute zero. So if we want to talk about something where we can say there is a zero and there is a scale on top of that that is also numerical, we actually would need to talk about temperature instead in terms of degrees Kelvin, because that gives us an absolute zero. So we can say today was this, yesterday was that, and we know where that is in relation to zero, not just that it's 6 more degrees than yesterday, but what does that mean on a bigger scale? So for example, if you're counting goals in a football match across games, scoring 4 is 100% more than scoring 2. But if you're giving people scores for skating out of 5, saying someone's a 5, or saying someone's a 4 isn't necessarily mean they're twice as good as giving them a rating of 2. So the ratings that you're, the data used there, say if you're rating their skating 1 to 5 would be ordinal, but if you're saying counting how many goals they score, that would be numerical and it would be ratio. So scoring 60% in a test doesn't mean knowing as twice as much as someone who scores 30%. Okay, it doesn't work like that. But it may be, because frequently these things are designed, if you're looking at assessments are often designed, so it's really easy to get the first bunch of points, and it's really, the further you go up the scale, the harder it is to get to the points. So the intervals between them are not equivalent. So it's a numerical scale, but it's not a ratio scale. I'm going to skip through this a bit. So one of the things that Henry's going to talk about tomorrow is, once we get data, how do we visualize it? And I'm going to put these slides up and let you read through them, but I'm not going to go through them just now. So we'll talk about how you select samples, and this is just going over what you've done before. Statistics, summary statistics, we have means, and we've talked about variance already. So I just wanted to talk a bit about an example, a concrete example of where you might be doing a study and using these sort of tests. I'll do that fairly quickly. So this is an example where you have a problem. You have children, in order to develop language, children need the opportunity to play. And it may be that if children don't have the opportunity to play, you have a theory about the fact that jokes are actually a good opportunity for language play. There's research out there that suggests this. that may then have an impact on their social development. Therefore, if you give them, if you have children who don't have opportunities to use jokes, for example, non-speaking children, then giving them an opportunity to do so may help improve their social communication skills. Okay, this is the basic idea. So basically the idea is looking at children with speech or language problems and giving them more opportunities to play by playing with jokes and looking to see if that improves their social communication or improves their language. So the general idea was this is a piece of software that was developed based on generation that was then used with children with complex communication needs, and in this particular case, children with cerebral palsy, in order to see if they could use it, and if they could use it, whether it impacted on their language skills. So that's the context. So these are the sort of jokes that the system could generate, which some of you have seen before. Okay, usually I take longer to go through and let you guess them, but I think some of you have seen them before, but you can look at the slides after. And this sort of type of joke is a fairly simple joke. It's a punning riddle, but you can computer generate these. And an interface was developed that enabled children to use this. And one of the problems is these particular children, some of them, because they have cerebral palsy, not only cannot speak, they may not be able to move. So some of them, for example, their whole means of communication may be, for example, using a switch. So one of the children, her whole means of control is that. That's what she can do. She can do that. That's the one thing she has control over. So you have to design an interface such that she can control it by just doing that. So that's a bit of an aside, but something that if you're interested in this stuff and come back to in third or fourth year, then come and see me. So the basic idea is that we ran a research study that involved an intervention where we first got baseline testing. So often with these sorts of studies, you have to find out, first of all, what's the language level of these children when you're starting? You test them and you find out their language level, and then you might apply an intervention. And this is a general method you might use if looking at the impact of any sort of, not as a treatment, but intervention study or an exploratory study to look and see what the impact is on language. Then they might be introduced to the system, they might then use the system for a while, and then you have an evaluation phase where you stop helping them and see what they can do, and then you do a post-intervention where you look and see the results. So this is just to say basically what happened with the study. I won't go through it in detail. But the thing that's of more interest to you here, so you can get standardized tests that measure aspects of language. They've been standardized because they have, what they've done is they've developed the test by testing it on large, large numbers and saying what would be the typical ability of a child at a particular level in terms of this test. So if you then use the test with a child and it says, according to the test, this child performs at the age of a chronological, 5.6 years, then it's because they've collected all the data that allows you to do that. So in this case, we're using two tests, a self-test of language fundamentals and PIPA, which is the test of phonological awareness. So this is trying to understand what the phonological awareness is of a child. This is just to give you an idea of the sorts of children and their levels of difficulty and their ages. Okay. So basically, videos were taken of the children, looked at those. I won't go through that in detail. But more interesting, we haven't got time to show you a video either, I'm afraid. Sorry about that. Okay, so if we look at the results on the tests, on these language tests, before and after using. So what we're asking here is, do we think that we have been able to, by using the software, they have been able to improve? Has it had an impact on their language? So in the case of the self-test, these were the scores the children had, pre-test and post, out of 27. And if you look on the PIPA, then again, the scores. Now, one thing to notice is that they're quite variable on the self-test. And one of the things you do when you first see data, you do a very technical thing, is you eyeball the data. Basically means you look at it and just see, do there seem to be any effects here? What does it look like? And looking at this, it looks like most of them improved, but you know, it may not have been a huge improvement, but we don't know yet. Is it a statistically significant improvement such that we can say that if we have a hypothesis that there may be an impact of using it, that we can accept that or reject it? So we've talked already about doing t-tests. Henry talked about them. So we can use a t-test on this data, and that's just to remind you. So for the PIPA test, this is the phonological awareness test. Pre-intervention, they had a mean of 12, post standard deviation 7.87, post 16 standard deviation. And in this case, the probability that the difference in the results pre and post test was due to chance was 0.006. Okay? So what that's saying is we have reason to believe we should reject the null hypothesis. So in terms of the study, we believe that according to the measurements on this test, that there was improvement in the children's phonological awareness through using the joke generation software. Because one of the ways the jokes works is it relies a lot on sounds of words. So if you remember the jokes I showed you there, a lot of it is about finding words that are similar and using them in the riddle. So the idea is to increase their awareness of the sounds of words. The t-test, the self-test, which is more about other aspects of language, in that case did the same thing. The probability of the result to the null hypothesis is 0.54. That means we can't reject the null hypothesis. There's no reason to accept it. So we don't have any evidence that there was any change in their performance on that. Having said that, the studies we did primarily were aimed at looking at how they could use the interface and whether they could use the interface. And we weren't actually really expecting any change at all because they're only using it for a small period of time. The fact that we got any result, any significant results for a small group of children means that we can't really conclude anything strong. What we really can say though is that's something we should explore further. They should have like a longer period of access to such software, and then we could look and see more closely whether there's any change. So that's just to say about some initial conclusions. We did also have fact that a lot of them then improved, a lot of them did things like they started telling jokes to other people, they'd start taking their jokes and sharing with them, they'd go next door and tell them to their neighbours using their various communication devices. Now in those cases, we're only at the stage of an observational study. We're saying we observe things that lead us to generate hypotheses. What we now need to do is design a further study that would allow us to investigate that more fully. It's just indicative results. It's not conclusive results of any kind that we can draw strong conclusions from. Okay. Stop there, because we're just about out of time. So sorry, that was a bit of a fast run through on some of the later things, but you can read up more on those if you want to. I'll add actually a reference to that to the page. So Henry tomorrow is going to talk a bit more about visualizing data, correlation, and chi-squared tests and how you might use those. And someone who mailed me that couldn't make, if I change the tutorial, is that you? Do you want to have a quick chat just now? Oh, it's the same room. Same room. It's all in the same place, yeah. So I forgot to add that information, yes. Yeah. I realised that it was just a late change because I'm just trying to get so much done at the moment. So what I would suggest is actually rather than coming back at 5, okay, particularly if you're elsewhere, then maybe have a look at the materials and try it yourself.
Sure, sure.
And then let us know
like,
if you
are they
want.
Available?
They are now on the webpage.
Okay, that's good.
They weren't at the time when I sent you the thing.
Thank you.
And then if you have any problems, just let us know after. So sorry about that.